Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. This week, the government dropped a surprise with its announcement that it was abolishing the 457 visa, which allows employers to bring in skilled workers from overseas for a limited period. The 457 visa is being replaced by a new system with short-term and medium-term streams and tighter conditions on the entry of foreign workers. To discuss the changes, we're joined today by Jenny Lambert, Director of Employment, Education and Training at the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Jenny Lambert, how has the business community reacted to what the government portrays as a tougher approach to foreign workers?
Michelle, I think that the key issue for the business communities is to try and reset the button on confidence in the temporary skilled migration system. So the big issue has been, we've seen over the last 5 years, community confidence draining away. There's been so much political heat around temporary skilled migration and 457 visas. We really have accepted that we have to get rid of the 457 visa and put in place arrangements that the community can be more confident in. That said, I mean, we've got some issues about the detail, and we're willing and wanting to work with the government on that.
Can we just unpack this community sentiment that you refer to? On the one hand, are people reacting against stories of rorting, of workers, foreign workers being underpaid and exploited? And or are we seeing just people taking an anti-foreigner attitude?
Well, I think there is an element of both. And I think we can see the issue of undermining, if you like, or lack of confidence in migration is not being just an Australian issue, but there's an international trend in this area. So I think there is that general pushback coming through a lot of discourse, whether through social media or otherwise, that is really bringing migration systems in general. And we've seen some changes in New Zealand and the UK and others where there's been some tightening. And I think Australia is part of that. So the specific issue, though, of concerns about the 457 visa is about publicity around the rorting. It is, though, also primarily about stakeholders, whether they be unions, whether they be talkback radio people or others that actually have really created concerns, some of them real, some of them perceptions. And I think that's a big issue.
Now, there has been a crackdown on rorting, hasn't there? So do you think that much rorting still exists?
We never believed that rorting was a big part of the 457 visa, and we still maintain that is the case. There is no doubt that there is some people who have used it not as employers to employees, but used it as sponsoring migration arrangements. So there's no doubt that the 457 has been used by some, but we contest the evidence shows not a very many, that have made arrangements for people to come in on a 457 visa and with the view of seeking a permanent migration outcome. So that's definitely was part of the issue. But look, the issue for us is when you look at the bigger picture of the use of the 457 over the last few years, the predominant users are state governments in their health portfolios, universities and academia, bringing in specialist researchers and scientists and lecturers, and also highly skilled CEOs and managers of multinational corporations. So 75% of the use of the 457 over the last 5 years has been in that high-skilled end. So when we talk about rorting, we've always seen it as more at the margins, at the lower-skilled end of the program.
Just on that point about it providing a permanent path to people becoming permanent residents, then citizens, couldn't one argue that this is in fact a not bad way to recruit migrants because they get some experience of the country, employers get experience of them? It may be a path that's better than someone just coming out of nowhere, as it were.
Yes, we agree with that. We certainly agree that the that we think 457 is what we call a try before you buy scheme for both the employers and the potential and the workers. So, I mean, so we think it has been a very valuable pathway to permanency. But one of the challenges is that once you actually create the pathway to permanency, you do create some of these perverse incentives, so people use it as that as the outcome. So, you know, we would have preferred to see that element retained. And certainly for that medium-term visa, there will be that element there. But they've basically just divided the skill levels and said, look, we're going to actually make it that at the lowest skilled end of the skilled list, it's going to be about, 2 years plus the potential to extend to 2 years, and then after that they have to leave. Or they can apply for the independent skilled approach, or we have to, they could go to the four-year one, but that's only at the higher skilled end.
The government's putting a lot of emphasis on the fact that it slashed a lot of occupations that have previously been on the list. You've made the point that many of these occupations haven't been used anyway, and it does seem that to take occupations like deer farmer, historian, archaeologist off the list is pretty meaningless. Anyway, couldn't many of the occupations that have been removed be just reclassified under the new lists, as it were?
Yes. I think there's a lot of commentary about the lists, but up until now, the 457 list was only a list of skilled occupations, all skilled occupations. But what was happening is, because of this political discourse, this negativity around the scheme, you had a problem where the community had been led to believe that there were people coming in under all these classifications. So again, the biggest issue for us is to restore public confidence. So if that means that the list has to be reduced to get rid of occupations that weren't doing a great deal anyway, but at least would improve the perception that the program was more targeted, we support that. Having said that, the second list, which is for the four-year visa at the higher skilled end, is much more limited, and it's not just the seldom used. There's a whole range of other occupations that have come off that list. So we will continue to work with the government, and the processes that they've announced is that every 6 and 12 months there'll be a review of what's on the list, and we'll be looking to make sure that the list contains those occupations that businesses are reaching out to say, I can't get this worker.
I noticed that one of the industry organisations was saying that this should now be non-political or taken out of politics and just be a settled, agreed policy. But isn't the truth that, in fact, foreign workers are a convenient political football that are used by both sides for their own purposes, and the parties just change positions when they're in government or opposition?
Yes, I must confess in the last 24 hours I've suggested that it would be wonderful to return the program back to bipartisan support, but I've only been left with outrageous laughter, at the idea that that would be the case. So I guess I have to join the cynics and say that bipartisan support in this space may be hard to achieve, but we do need to try and minimise the points of disconnect between the community's common sense questioning about the program. Should there be advertising? Should there be archaeologists on the list? Should there be all those questions that they say, has that passed the pub test in Australia? If we can get rid of those questions, then we can at least try and minimise the attack points and get it down to the raw politics of disagreement.
What about the so-called naming and shaming? The government seems to be suggesting that businesses who don't put enough effort into recruiting Australians will be exposed. Isn't this a bit excessive?
Well, we certainly need to work more with the government as to what they mean by that and what's going to be the tests for that. And it's like all of these things, it's a lot of detail in what's being announced, and we'll need to work through with the processes of government as to what they mean. So, yes, we would be very concerned if the community is misled that, you know, businesses aren't putting in effort when they are. But, you know, there are a lot of changes that have been made in this program that should serve to really narrow it and target it. And, you know, hopefully the overall picture for the community will be what matters.
Now, just turning to next month's budget, what will business be looking for out of that budget?
Well, the main thing, of course, our pressure from the business community is to get certainty and fiscal responsibility. So we'd be definitely looking at continuing to support the government in keeping a tight rein on government spend. There is one area, though, we took forward in the budget that was a significant investment the government needs to make, and that is in the area of vocational training and apprenticeships. And we have strongly encouraged through our pre-budget submission the importance of maintaining the Commonwealth's investment in vocational training.
And this fits in, of course, to the foreign workers debate.
Definitely. We see them all as connected, and we see the idea that we've got to present to the community that governments are wanting to support the skilling of young people, the reskilling of people as they change careers, as the economy changes and as industries restructure. And the vocational training system is a significant component of that, because there's been significant real increase in investment in schools and higher ed. But in the last few years, between the investment of the state government and the federal governments, there's been a significant decrease in investment. And particularly, there's been all the controversy around vet fee help and the problems associated with that program. And when you take out the loans in that system and just talk about hard-edge qualifications investment, really we're talking about a really downscaling of investment. And we say, look, you can't afford to leave this the poor cousin in the education and training system, because it produces all of the trades workers as well as a lot of other qualifications across the economy.
Of course, the public debate at the moment around the budget is centred on housing affordability. Do you think that too much emphasis is being put on what the government can and should do in this area?
Well, I think that the government only has a few levers to pull. There's many other factors involved in housing affordability other than just what the government can do, particularly when you just talk about the federal government. So you've got federal government issues, you've got state government issues, you know, what they're doing in the area of planning. Are they creating enough supply in terms of government-owned land? You've got local governments involved in approval. So you've got to look at, you know, that arrangement and whether that's, you know, supporting supply. And you've got to look at the way that really housing affordability is largely a Sydney Melbourne issue. You know, so although that's, you know, it is, you know, to some extent an important issue in other cities. Perth used to be an issue, but of course it's changed. So we need to be careful when we're talking about housing affordability to concentrate on where the real problems are, and looking at ways that we can, you know, improve supply, encourage people to look at, you know, housing outside of Sydney and Melbourne, which talks about, you know, whether it be regional jobs growth or other cities' jobs growth. You know, there's a whole range of issues wrapped up here, and it's not just about, you know, the federal government being able to solve housing affordability.
If the government cut the capital gains tax discount, which is an option that seems to be still firmly on the table, do you think that that would cause serious problems in the housing market that would flow onto the economy, or can you just fine-tune the housing market to some extent by doing that?
Well, I think that the trouble when you pull those types of levers of capital gains or negative gearing, you are affecting all across Australia. You're affecting investment across Australia, not just in the areas that are suffering the problem. So you, what you don't want to do is actually minimise supply of housing as a result of taking investors out of the market. So you've got to be very careful that we're not just talking about housing ownership, but also rental opportunities and making sure that those are available. So you have to be very mindful that if you try and solve a problem that is happening in a narrow but significant part of Australia, are you going to affect whole of Australia with solutions that aren't suitable for where there's no problem? Because one of the really big drivers that's very important for the economy and for people is construction in housing. So housing construction is a big part of the economy, and getting that supply up is also a big part. So you've just got to make sure you're not affecting too many of those. So we don't support wholesale changes in either the capital gains or in the negative gearing, but we do support the governments collectively as well as community and Reserve Bank looking at all the factors that impact housing affordability.
The climate, the public climate in which a budget is delivered is important, and a recent Essential poll found widespread negativity among voters about their current economic circumstances and their prospects for the future. These were gauged across a number of issues, including job security, housing affordability, general standard of living. What are your broad predictions for the state of the Australian economy in the year ahead?
Well, I mean, the surveys that we've undertaken have indicated a slight upturn in business confidence. And from the other indicators of business confidence, they are looking cautiously optimistic. That said, I mean, there's a lot of geopolitical issues going on in the world at the moment, and that may create more international business stability. And we are creatures not just of what's happening in Australia, but we're creatures very much in the business community of what's happening globally. So it's, I mean, if we could ever predict what Trump or North Korea will do, I guess we're all would be, you know, congratulating ourselves on our crystal ball. So those things can make a difference. So for us, I mean, if we look just at the domestic issues, we'd say cautiously optimistic. There are signs of growth. I mean, in the last employment statistics, there were signs of full-time jobs growth, even though the unemployment rate stayed the same. But that meant participation was up, which just means that more people are coming into the system. So I think there is a, there are signs that we can be a little bit optimistic.
So if there are so-called green shoots around, why do you think ordinary people feel so out of sorts about their situation?
Well, I mean, I think that's a general feeling about, is the world a little bit out of control at the moment? I mean, I would have said that, you know, people are feeling that there's a lot of negative comment about what's going on. In Australian politics, you'd have to say, you know, is the discourse becoming so negative? They can't seem to find common ground on anything. That is obviously affecting Australians' sense of certainty. Do they know where their government is going? Do they know where governments collectively are going? Because we've got to remember we've got this crazy federated system in Australia. So I think all of those things play into that sense of confidence. And you'd hope for Australians' point of view that the future is brighter than they may think it is, and we're obviously doing our bit in the business community to make sure we can keep, you know, their jobs ticking over and business growing and getting the economy going.
Jenny Lambert, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all for our Conversations Politics podcast. Thanks to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back with another interview soon. Goodbye for now.